Welcome to Friday and welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. This is where we take an hour and learn from what happened this week and figure out what mattered the most. We have this hour from the Seattle Times, Briar Dudley. Nice to see you.
Hi, thanks.
What's your title there? Columnist, op-ed columnist?
Sure, opinion columnist, editorial writer.
From Q13 Fox, political analyst, C.R. Douglas. Hey, C.R.
Good afternoon.
And from The Stranger, what's your title, reporter Sydney Brownstone?
Reporter Sydney Brownstone.
See how we did that?
Yeah.
So let's start with the fact that this week the two candidates for Washington governor held their final debate, and maybe you heard it, or maybe you had just listened to the presidential debate on KUOW and you just couldn't handle one more. You might have missed it. C.R. Douglas, you moderated the thing. What'd we miss?
I did. It was a great exchange. It was in Pasco, I would say, from my perch as the moderator. The mood in the room and the reaction afterwards was a little more pro-Bryant, but this is kind of red country over there. I'm not sure how it would have played statewide. Probably Inslee would have gotten a nod in a place like King County with those viewers.
Were there people cheering and applauding and yelling?
There were. You know, there were rules that you weren't supposed to applaud, but they always break them.
Why do we even make that rule?
So
why do we even have an audience if we don't want them to react?
Exactly. So a couple times they did interrupt with applause. Both times it was to favor Bill Bryant. One of those was about homelessness. It was one of the most interesting exchanges, I think, of the night. It was actually a question I was asking. It was a submitted question, but I was the one that was delivering it. And it was, given all this problem with homelessness that we're seeing in city after city after city, you know, should the state take a bigger role? And so the question was, is it time for a homelessness czar to really coordinate our response and do something? It went to Inslee first, and he said, you know, we're doing a lot now and we've got a lot going on. And, you know, so he certainly didn't think it was time for a homelessness czar. And as he's speaking, I'm thinking, wow, this is Bill Bryant's chance. You know, I can see a big divide here where he's going to say, yes, we need one. And so as he's speaking, he finishes up and I turn to Bill Bryant and I say, Bill Bryant, do we need a homelessness czar? And he said, we don't need a homelessness czar. We need a governor. And that got huge applause. And it was really one of the best moments of the night for him, I think. I mean, he didn't go where I thought he was going to go. I thought he was going to say, yes, we should need a czar, but he probably...
So he's blaming homelessness on Governor Inslee?
Well, he's blaming the governor for not being more proactive on a lot of things. So it fit his whole narrative, and it got applause. And I think that was a strong moment for him. There's a lot of concern about homelessness. Whether he has the right plan, I don't know. But he sure says that he would give it a bigger priority than the governor has.
Seattle Times, Briar Dudley, your paper just endorsed Jay Inslee. Was there anything controversial about that? Sometimes you've gone for Republicans.
Well, no. You know, that's an interesting point that Bryant makes about leadership. You know, I think Jay's response in that debate was to kind of go on about affordable housing and things like that, to take it that direction. Clearly, there's a leadership vacuum on homelessness, and Seattle should not be bearing the brunt of it completely. Seattle homeowners and business owners and renters who pay these taxes and support the $50 million a year that Seattle's spending endlessly with no solution in sight, they need some relief. Maybe that'll come from King County. Maybe that'll come from the state. Hopefully, Jay, if he gets elected, will be invigorated to show more leadership on this.
Reporter Sydney Brownstone, what do you think we should know about the governor's contest this time around?
Well, it's really interesting that Bill Bryant is taking a zero-tolerance policy towards homeless encampments and at the same time promising no new taxes. So if we do need a homelessness czar, and if we do need more help from the state, and if we do need more help from King County, that likely means we need financial help, we need taxes. So to me, that was really lacking from Bill Bryant's explanation of how he would deal with homelessness. I was also, frankly, disappointed with Jay Inslee. I mean, he reiterated that he had spent $240 million on homelessness, but he didn't weigh in on what Seattle's doing, the types of legislation they're discussing at the moment, which I think is really interesting. I was also disappointed with both sides over their question to a question about police brutality. There's currently an initiative going on the November ballot called I-873 that would change the law to make it easier to hold killer cops accountable for homicide. And they could have supported that one, but I think they both said that they're waiting for an answer back.
Just to be clear, that's next November.
November. My bad.
Hey, Sydney, I'm curious. Don't homeless advocates say that for every $100 increase in rent, there's a 15% increase in homelessness? So if that's correct, then wouldn't increasing taxes exacerbate the problem of homelessness?
Well, I don't know where those numbers are coming from, but I think that the neighborhood groups are really angry about the fact that they're being asked to pay more in property taxes each year. But the fact of the matter is that Seattle is not taxed wildly disproportionately in terms of their property taxes. It's just increasing in tandem with property values. So in terms of the taxes that we ask from our homeowners, it's actually not that bad.
We're going to talk more about homelessness in Seattle, what's happening with that camping ordinance, so-called. That's coming up later in the show. C.R. Douglas, correct me if I'm wrong, Governor Inslee is on his way to winning re-election. But what about the chances of the Washington legislature going Democrat? Could that happen?
Yeah, I think he is on his way. It's been basically a 10-point race. He's been in the lead for almost a year with all the polling. It's pretty much stuck at that. Bill Bryant's tried a lot of different things to get traction, and he's just not. A lot of reasons for that, but probably the most is that it's a Democratic state. So there's a real headwind for any Republican running. When it comes to the GOP Senate, which they hold a couple seat advantage, that is vulnerable if you get a big anti-Trump wave. There are a couple moderate kind of Republicans. One is Steve.
Or even Trump convincing his supporters to stay home because the election is rigged.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that could depress turnout on the Republican side as much as on the Democratic side. So it could be self-defeating for him. But you have a guy like Steve Litzow, who is in Mercer Island, which has, you know, become almost a Democratic district. He's a Republican, been there for a while. So it's kind of moved more purple since he's been there. If you get a big anti-Trump wave and a real pro-Hillary Clinton wave in the opposite direction, and that spread is big enough, you're going to have a lot of down ballot casualties. And one of them could be some of these senators, and they could lose control, the GOP, of the Senate.
Breyer, what would be the most important thing about the Washington State Legislature being Democratic controlled with a Democratic governor?
Well, you know, regardless of which party you affiliate with, you've got to recognize that there's value in having some balance in our legislature, in Congress. You know, if you have only one party in all three houses, you know, if you have House, Senate, Governor, you know, plus the state offices, you know, you lose some of the checks and balances down there. I think, you know.
Doesn't that mean something finally gets done, whether you like it or not?
Well, maybe, you know, unless they eat themselves, you know. But the, you know, one of the losses I see in the Issaquah race, which is one of the turning ones between, you know, State Senator Mark Mullitz challenged by Chad Magindas, both those guys are really smart, and you know, you start the pool of really smart legislators isn't as big as you might think, and when they start fighting against each other, then you start losing some of that talent and knowledge. So, and there's going to be some newcomers, and it'll be hard. They're in the red zone of finishing some really complex stuff. So, you know, the turnover is a concern.
Sydney, most important thing about a Democratic legislature and governor?
It might be able to get something done. I mean, I think that a lot of Jay Inslee's efforts have been hamstrung by an obstructionist Republican Senate. They've really blocked a lot of legislation, climate, for example. They've held bike lanes hostage. This is the Republican Party nationally, obviously, to me at least, has completely discredited itself. But to deny that there are elements of that here in Washington State would be silly. I mean, our state GOP chair was defending Trump's comments about sexually assaulting women. So I think that the Democratic Party will actually, one wing of it will become the new Republican Party, and we'll see a new left emerge out of the more leftist wing.
CR?
I have a theory here that the Republican control of the state Senate has actually helped Inslee. If he had had a Democratic Senate for the last couple of years, they probably would have pushed the pedal on taxes, maybe a bottled water tax, maybe a capital gains tax, maybe a climate tax. I mean, he would have been much more vulnerable. I mean, an anti-tax message is how you're going to win as a Republican in the state of Washington. You're not going to win in social issues. You're going to kind of win on this fiscal moderation message. And because they've stopped all the kind of, you know, tax impulses of Democrats, he is not vulnerable, really, to the tax issue.
So Democrats raise taxes, and the way to keep Democrats in office is to not raise taxes.
Well, and I go further and say Tim Iman has helped Democrats, because over the years, by stopping taxes and reducing them, it has given, well, I should say it's taken away a Republican challenger's best message. You know, when red governors get elected in blue states, and they do across the country, they never do in Washington. It's almost always on an anti-tax, tax relief platform. which kind of can resonate in these blue states. It would resonate in Washington. Look at, we passed these Tim Iman initiatives, but he's taken them all off the table. There is nothing to run on the tax message if you're Republican, except we'll stop new ones. Well, that's not quite the same rallying cry as tax relief. So it's helped Democrats.
Well, apparently the Russians are offering to send election monitors to our polling places. That's a true thing, to monitor our rigged election. So, of course, we don't have polling places in Washington anyway.
Pajalista.
Pajalista? Well, I don't know what that means.
It just means please.
Oh, I didn't just cuss in Russian, did I?
No.
Okay, very good. Speaking of the presidential race, you know, in Washington, we're used to being irrelevant in the election, just because not only can the Democrat take our votes for granted, but the candidates are never from here. But the WikiLeaks email release shows the Clinton campaign considered three Seattleites for vice president: Bill Gates, Melinda Gates, and Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz. We were this close to being this close to the presidency. I'm kind of glad not to know the skeletons Melinda Gates has in her closet. You know, the opposition research that would be coming out. I don't really want to know.
Clippy.
Clippy? Yeah. Who knows what's under Clippy if you pry that thing up. Trump calling Bill Gates a loser for giving away his money to cure malaria. one more thing on the presidential race. You know, America has this tradition of presidential candidates doing comedy. The annual Al Smith Dinner is an October fundraiser for Catholic Charities. So every 4 years, the candidates traditionally come and do a little stand-up. So how was last night as comedy? We have a professional opinion for you. Comedian Dana Gould wrote and produced The Simpsons, and he has stand-up specials on HBO and Comedy Central. I saw him on stage in Los Angeles. Dana, good to talk to you.
Hi, Bill. How are you?
Good, good. I want to play a little Donald Trump for you first.
Oh, this one's going to get me in trouble. Not with Hillary. You know, the president told me to stop whining. But I really have to say, the media is even more biased this year than ever before. Ever. You want the proof? Michelle Obama gives a speech, and everyone loves it. It's fantastic. They think she's absolutely great. My wife, Melania, gives the exact same speech. And people get on her case.
Stand-up comedian Dana Gould, what'd you think?
I thought that was the best joke of the night.
Mm.
Credit where credit is due.
How did it work? Why did it work?
It's just a great joke. It was self-deprecating, of course, at the expense of his wife, because I think this is as close as he can come to being self-deprecating.
Right.
But it wasn't about his opponent. It was about ostensibly his campaign. It was a beautiful joke, well delivered. You know, credit where credit is due. I did hear the dinner. I hear most of it. It surprises no one that he. You know, these aren't two natural comedians.
No.
That's
clear.
They do not know their senses of humor about themselves or others. And it was, by and large, somewhat cringe-inducing. It's a very bizarre rodeo that these four people have to go through to become president.
Yeah, a weird twist for them to have to do a little of everything.
Yeah.
Here's a little Hillary for you.
People look at the Statue of Liberty and they see a proud symbol of our history as a nation of immigrants, a beacon of hope for people around the world. Donald looks at the Statue of Liberty and sees a four. Maybe a five if she loses the torch and tablet and changes her hair.
Dana, I thought that was good stuff, but she seemed to start to lose the room.
That was a good joke. Could have been a great joke if she had delivered it in a way that was less accusatory. What you do is, what we would, in comedy, you flip the script. You turn it into a false positive. It would have been a better joke had she said, people see it as a symbol of hope, of what our country stands for. Donald sees even more in it. He sees a four.
Mm-hmm.
You know, raise expectations and then you dash them.
Right, right. Okay.
That would have been a little bit funny.
Rule of comedy. You zig and then you zag.
Yeah, you do the thing and then you do the thing. I just thought it was like these two people, you know, roasts are normally when friends roast each other. These two aren't friends. There's not a lot of love lost between them. I just thought the whole thing was uncomfortable. It was sort of like, you know, a bad joke that your mother would make at your dad's expense during the middle of a fight that they would say to you that you would have to laugh at. It's like, I don't want to be in the room.
Right. The roast only works if it's affectionate.
Yeah. And you have to have a sense of humor about yourself. I found the funniest thing was, you know, Rudy Giuliani's, in the, you know, the scowl on their face when she was joking about Rudy Giuliani. Purportedly, Donald Trump's entire run for the presidency was finally hammered home when Obama made fun of him at the correspondence dinner like 2 or 3 years ago, and he famously scowled through the entire speech. You have to be able to laugh at yourself even if you don't mean it when you're in public like that.
Actually, that was a pretty good bit of comedy on the part of the Al Smith dinner organizers to put the Catholic cardinal in between the two candidates. That was a nice touch.
Yeah. I thought it was a nice touch. The whole thing is just this, you know, and tonight they have to fight with a hammer. You know, what else do we have to make these poor people do?
One more for you. This is Trump. A lot of people said Trump lost the room here.
Everyone knows, of course, Hillary's belief that it takes a village, which only makes sense, after all, in places like Haiti, where she's taken a number of them. Thank you.
Thank you, he says at the end. Every comic has to decide whether to acknowledge the hostile crowd or not.
Yeah, well, that was an example of a joke that becomes a threat. You know, I would hearken back to the Rat Pack. You know, Dean Martin was very funny. Dean Martin had a natural sense of levity about him, a natural lightness to him, and he would say these hilarious jokes. And then Frank Sinatra would steal them and say them, and they would sound like threats. you know, you just have to know how to tell a joke. And, that is a man that does not.
Dana Gould knows how to tell a joke. In fact, he's got a new, you'd see him on stage, but also I understand you got a new horror comedy out?
Yeah, I have a new TV series entitled Stand Against Evil that is based on the premise, what if my dad was Buffy the Vampire Slayer? And it stars John C. McGinley, and it premieres on IFC November 2nd.
Stand Against Evil. And there's the Dana Gould Hour podcast. Dana Gould, thanks for talking with us.
Hey, good to talk to you again, Bill.
You too. More on KOW's Week in Review coming up. We're going to cover what happened in Seattle schools, Black Lives Matter t-shirts, and Sound Transit 3. And as we said, we're going to get into what actually is happening with the rules about camping while homeless in Seattle. That and more coming up, so stay tuned.
I've got to say, there are a lot of friendly faces here in this room, people that I've been privileged to know and to work with. I just want to put you all in a basket of adorables.
It's KUOW's Week in Review, covering what mattered about this week gone by with The Strangers, Sidney Brownstone, and Q13 Fox, C.R. Douglas, and The Seattle Times, Briar Dudley. Seattle teachers hope their cause is not lost amid the noise over Black Lives Matter shirts. This week, public school teachers in and near Seattle wore BLM shirts to class, and the idea came out in part of a protest that happened at John Muir Elementary, or that didn't happen because of the backlash to that. People, they were going to have their Black Men Uniting to Change the Narrative event at John Muir last month, and that got canceled after some threats over teachers' plans to wear Black Lives Matter shirts. So the school district got the approval of the PTSA, of the school board, and you had students and parents wearing Black Lives Matter stickers and buttons. Now, I can't tell you what Seattle teachers said because Seattle Public Schools didn't let reporters in, so KOW's education reporter Ann Dornfeld went to the Highline School District, White Center Heights Elementary, where most of their students are kids of color.
The previous day, the class had discussed things they'd heard said about their skin color.
And I was really touched by what you shared with me and with the class in terms of what people have said.
Riley read from the list.
You have nasty black skin. that somebody in our class had that said to them. Oh, you're black, so you are the color of poop. Somebody said that outside someone's apartment, right? How do these things make us feel?
The kids offered theories about why people might say those kinds of things.
Because they just don't like your outside, but they're not looking on the inside.
Yeah.
Or maybe they got bullied by somebody else.
In another classroom, Sally Wilma's 5th and 6th graders discussed police brutality.
Sometimes I'm kind of thinking, why are police officers around if they're going to do something that's not necessary?
Yeah, police officers, we need them, but they shouldn't be killing black people. Like, they react so fast. Like, I agree, like, if, like, there's something in a black person's hand, then they just react that it's a gun and they don't really know what it is.
Other students wanted to know why people are called black or white when their skin is actually brown or pink. And why did white people enslave black people to begin with? Every time one student finished speaking, Sally Wilma could hardly keep up as hands shot up all over the classroom, kids eager to answer each other's questions.
I'm so proud of you all that you're thinking this way and that you're willing to do something about it, because there was, I think, a generation that was very complacent and didn't. And I'm glad there's activism.
So let's talk about what this event said about Seattle and its schools. CRU had said it says something about the strength of teachers' positions these days.
It does. That was my first reaction. You know, there's a lot of solidarity in the Seattle Teachers Union that has shown up in the last couple of years. They were not that strong, you know, just 3-4 years ago. But look at in the last year, they had this amazingly successful strike a year ago, got basically everything they wanted. They had that very successful protest against standardized testing, where they really fought against the district and won. Now you have this show of solidarity, which to get 2,000 teachers to be a part of that, I think they have 5,000 or 6,000, I mean, you know, teachers total. So you're talking a huge chunk of teachers involved in this. I'm just impressed with the coordination, the solidarity, and the muscle behind the Seattle Teachers Union in the last couple of years.
Well, you need muscle to do something controversial. Was this controversial, do you think?
Absolutely, it was controversial. I mean, there are people who say this isn't appropriate, that you know, where does it end? I mean, Black Lives Matter may be, you know, a symbol that kind of you would allow, but what about the next thing that's even more extreme or Nazi or, you know?
What about Blue Lives Matter shirts? I mean, there was some of that
discussion. I'm imagining the problem the district's going to get in with where they basically endorse this, and where does it stop?
I think it's also, like, just the fact that the statement Black Lives Matter is considered controversial in our country is ludicrous.
Well, there's the phrase and then there's the group, right?
Right. Let's acknowledge that it's a decentralized movement. You know,
right.
It's not like this is a group in the traditional sense of the word. And like when we think of 1960s or 1970s protest groups, this is not the same thing. And we've seen that in the new millennium. But the other thing I wanted to add on to what Ciara was saying, the really successful protest last year, the teachers' strike, one of the things that they were able to show with that expression of solidarity is that they were not just advocating for themselves as teachers, they were also advocating for their students. One of the things that they fought for was recess time, guaranteed 20 minutes of recess for their students. And the reason they were fighting for that was because there was an inequitable distribution of time. And I think if we also look at the achievement gap in Seattle schools, it often falls on lines of race and class. And for Seattle teachers to be wearing Black Lives Matter shirts is something that they're doing for their students. It's to make them know that they are important and they are valued.
In fact, some of the teachers got signs that said Black students' lives matter. So there really it was a bit, our education reporter told us, it was a bit teacher by teacher. It wasn't like a district-wide curriculum went along with this.
Your student, the clip you had there was very touching. Those students were, you know, their thoughtfulness and sensitivity to that was pretty remarkable for those little kids. I have to say that tempered my initial concerns about this, because, you know, one, there shouldn't be organized political activity happening in schools by teachers. I'm sorry. That you shouldn't, it is not a forum for organized political activity like that. But the topic, of course, is huge and important, and it's part of education, and it's part of life, and it's things that need to be discussed in schools.
Would you have preferred the discussion without the Black Lives Matter shirts?
Well, I don't know. That's a good question. You know, it sounds like the teacher, at least the teacher that you all had just aired, you know, they handled it very well, and they had a really productive conversation, painful but productive conversation. One thing I wonder about, you know, I've got elementary school age kid, and you know, safety is a concern at this age. And you know, you're teaching these kids how to, you know, be safe and go around the world. And the message with police is complicated. You know, it's complicated depending on your skin color. You know, a black parent would have a different conversation than I'm going to have with my white children, and that's horrible. At the same time, all children need to realize that in a scary situation, you know, a police officer is, you need to look to them, and you need to have some faith that they're going to watch out for you. So let's say your kid is walking home and somebody's stalking him and there's a policeman on the next block. Should we be scaring kids away from the police because they think that they're going to get shot?
Do you think this event muddled that message? You heard one of the students saying, well, why do we have police if they... her words, right, where if they do the wrong thing.
Exactly. Sometimes police are the scary situation, and the Black Lives Matter movement has done an amazing job of exposing that that's a reality for a lot of people in our country. And the other thing about this word political is that I find that it often gets thrown out when there's just something that the dominant narrative disagrees with. And when we put the political framework on a movement, it's often coming from a very white-centric perspective. And it just... like, let's acknowledge that we're all white people talking about Black Lives Matter here. That's part of the problem. You know, there's not representation.
Well, that's right. Well, the onus is on the teacher to have a nuanced conversation.
By the way, I interviewed the organizer, Jesse Hagopian, that you can hear at KUOW.org. Huh.
Yes. Because, you know, these are children, and it's not a binary consideration about police. I mean, not all police are bad. There are some bad police. They've done some horrible things. But... not all, and most of them are good people who are out there to help. And so that's a trickier thing to impart to students, you know. And you want them to realize that it's nuanced, and not everybody with a uniform is bad, or not everybody with a particular skin color, you know, obviously. So, you know, how do you have that nuance? When do you start introducing these nuanced considerations about people of authority? And that's a real interesting thing. And it's a conversation we all got to have with our kids, and teachers have got to help. And, you know, I don't know. Black Lives Matter, maybe that's the right vehicle to do it. But it's nuanced.
Well, even if we didn't want, quote unquote, politics in the school because that's best handled at home, are you having those thorny conversations with your white elementary school child at home, or is it only happening in the school?
Yeah, well, it all varies. You know, we've had conversations in my house. It's a great topic. And, you know, we're at actually a very exciting time where our country is really evolving. You know, we see that with race relations, and we're addressing some of these disparities. We're having conversations. You know, the head of the police, national police fraternity, brought this up and said, hey, we're wrong and we need to come along. We're seeing it with misogyny because of Donald Trump. You know, we've seen it with the Confederate flag. I think we're maturing as a nation and kind of getting to a better place, and that's fantastic. And I just hope that we don't screw up that progress.
Our education reporter, Ann Dornfeld, quoted a teacher who said, teaching is inherently political. Do you mind, or would you mind, your teacher being political in class? And would you need to know the teacher's politics before you answered? Is that okay?
I would certainly hope my teacher was political. I mean, some of the best teachers I've ever had have been exceptionally political in terms of, like, teachers of AP U.S. government and history. I think that the dominant narrative of U.S. history has often left out the genocide and slavery parts. And a teacher who is political, to me, means a teacher who is educated and willing to address that and willing to teach the students the truth.
But does that mean we have to screen out conservative teachers if you don't want conservative politics in the classroom?
That's a good question. I haven't arrived at an answer.
I would say absolutely not. I mean, you would want all stripes, and I've had all stripes. And in high school, I'm thinking of my high school social studies teacher who was, you know, pretty leftist, and he was out about that. But what you want and what is sort of required in those moments is not hiding your viewpoint, but exposing you to kind of the other sides and sort of making it clear, you know, that on, I mean, back then it was the nuclear freeze movement. I think he was really into it. And, you know, but sort of talking about both sides of it. We want that to happen. I don't think we want teachers to play no role in terms of having views on politics. But you don't want to use kind of a public employee to impart, you know, a political message only. I mean, I'm just imagining the different things you could do. I mean, what if they all wanted 15 Now T-shirts? What if they wanted, you know, yes on the carbon tax? I mean, you wouldn't want.
But is that equivalent to you to a Black Lives Matter shirt?
Well, it's a political shirt. So in that sense, you know, I don't want to be the one having to make judgment calls here, but I think we would not want a 2,000 members of the Seattle School District wearing in a coordinated fashion approved by the district, you know, yes on the carbon tax initiative 723. I mean, that's a real political statement about something that's on the ballot, right? That we don't want public funds and public schools to be used to politic, if you will, in that way.
But maybe the productive thing is having these conversations in the first place and having these conversations in the schools. I mean, I've thought about kids watching this current election. They're learning nothing about some of the most important issues of the day by watching Donald Trump debate Hillary Clinton. So if you're able to have a conversation about 732, the carbon tax in the classroom, or Black
Absolutely.
Lives Matter, that seems productive. And to have all viewpoints represented seems like a good place to start for me.
Well, that's the Black Lives Matter event that happened this week. And we heard from listeners, pro, con. And as I say, I interviewed the organizer of that event who said more about why this is happening and why events like this matter. You can go to KUOW.org and hear that. And our Week in Review is going to continue. More to come after this break. This week's Week in Review on KUOW is opinion columnist Briar Dudley from the Seattle Times, reporter Sydney Brownstone from The Stranger, and political analyst C.R. Douglas from Q13 Fox. Let's talk about the Seattle Times recommendation this week, Briar, of a no vote on the Sound Transit 3 ballot measure. Why vote no?
Because it's a permanent blank check and removes the periodic votes that people in the Puget Sound area have had to hold Sound Transit accountable. You know, we think that more transit investments are needed in this area to address congestion that's going to continue to increase, to help people get around, to give people more options. At the same time, this proposal takes away some control that voters have had over their taxation and investments.
Why is that?
Well, because it, you know, the first two phases of Sound Transit, they came back each, you know, what was it, 2008? We approved Sound Transit 2. That gave voters an opportunity to say, hey, yes or no, you're going the right direction. Let's correct course a little bit. In fact, on Sound Transit 2, they did correct course. There was an enormous proposal in 2007, this kind of blob of transit and roads and things like that. And voters in the Puget Sound area said, hey, that's too much. You know, we don't really like this approach. And they said no. So then, not too long afterward, they came out with a tighter, more focused plan, ST2, which is actually delivering all kinds of benefits to the region, and that was approved.
So, well, what's the problem with the ST3 package that you think a no vote would have them go back and correct?
This provides $54 billion for 25 years initially, ongoing taxes. You know, we don't have to have any more votes. They can just continue on. They lose that accountability. They lose the pressure of having to come back to voters and say, look, we've performed over this last 5 years or 8 years. We deserve another chunk of your money. Another question is the cost benefit of this thing. It's been hustled through really quickly to get onto the ballot, the presidential ballot. You know, the financial plan for this project wasn't even available when they did all their public outreach. The cost benefit analysis that looks really closely at, you know, the return on the public's investment, that wasn't even available when the Sound Transit Board approved this thing in June.
Do you think there's not enough return on investment?
Well, that's debatable. You know, that's another aspect of this one. It's extremely expensive the most expensive light rail project in the world. And light rail, you know, is it the best system to be using light rail trains, which are low capacity vehicle designed for inner city transit? Is that the is that how we want to be connecting, you know, Olympia to Everett eventually?
Let's talk more about that. The stranger, Sydney Brownstone, expensive and a permanent blank check, says Seattle Times.
First of all, I'm a little bit confused about the characterization of light rail as low capacity. Is that lower capacity than a passenger vehicle in an HOV lane? No, that's the answer. Secondly,
you mean heavy rail? Is that the comparison you were making prior?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the sounder's great. You know, we've got fantastic train.
Dedicated, out of traffic. Big cars.
Big trains. I mean, that's what they do in other world-class cities to connect cities to the suburban cities as they use heavy rail. Within the city, they use light rail. But we're trying to morph light rail to become our regional transit system, and that's a little bit of a challenge.
Well, one of the most important parts of ST3 is that it would connect West Seattle to Ballard. So that's something that we absolutely need, and we needed probably 15 years ago. So the permanent tax authority thing that you're talking about is only needed for operations and maintenance. Let's be clear about that. The other thing is, like, how else do you pay for a major infrastructure project? That's how you get stuff done. You change the tax authority. And people who are upset at this tax authority being changed can hold King County executives accountable for that when it comes time to vote. The other thing is that the cost associated with this. So it would cost the average adult in our region about $169 a year, which is just $5 more than a yearly Seattle Times subscription, I might add. That's $14 a month. It's really nothing. And it takes, I mean, we're expecting 800,000 more people to come streaming into the city in the next 40 years. And to expect just cars and our current infrastructure to deal with that is preposterous. This would move people to some critical places that people are already living in.
Before we get to places, Sydney, the Seattle Times said that this would cost the average King County household $20,000 over 25 years. Are we agreeing on numbers at least?
No. The proponents are pretty, you know, they're slicing off the incremental increase from ST3 for an individual. If you look at the average household in King County or within the Sound Transit District, you know, it's over two. So you start multiplying that up and then you get much closer to 20,000 plus. You know, actually really in King County, you're probably $20,000, $30,000 per household on average over the life of this when you factor in the incremental increase from ST3. And also this vote is not just ST3 taxes, it's extending the ST2 taxes. So the combined bundle, you're going to put $20,000 or $30,000 into this.
As for what we're paying for, Sydney, the Times is saying, you know, you like West Seattle to Ballard, but the Times take was that it's too much out in the suburbs where it's less dense. What do you say to that?
Well, I mean, we have to extend the light rail lines out to the suburbs because ST3, Sound Transit has this thing called sub-area equity, which means that we basically need to treat every area that's raising money for Sound Transit in an equitable fashion. And that's a really, really wonky thing that I'm not going to get into. But there's a reason for that. And it's to make sure that everyone gets a piece of the pie that they're contributing to. The other thing is that there seems to be like this ideological opposition to making the world better for our kids. Like one of the big problems that the Seattle Times editorial board identified is that the entire thing would take, you know, decades. What's wrong with that? What's wrong with anticipating growth?
You hate children, Breyer? Is that fair?
Clearly. It's all about keeping them down.
Well, the endorsement did say that most people wouldn't see the benefit because it's so far out. But isn't that an investment in the future?
Well, you know, is it the right investment? That's the question. We didn't say stop everything. We didn't say kill transit. We didn't say don't make this a better place. We said this plan isn't the best plan. We should demand something better. We said we should demand a plan that's more accountable. We should break it into pieces. Let's come back with something that provides maybe a 7 or an 8 year periodic vote. What if something changes dramatically around here? What if Amazon opens its next headquarters in Kitsap County and, you know, we're building, extending light rail in another direction? Maybe we should take the $8 billion tunnel that's going to go to Ballard and build a tunnel to Kitsap County to serve them. We don't, you know,
that's, is that a recipe for never acting on transit?
No, it's a recipe for providing more flexibility. It's providing a more nimble plan for the region so that it can adapt to changes in the future. And by the way, the suburbs are connected now. under the plan we approved in 2008. You know, we're right now, if you get out of the Seattle bubble, you'll see that they're building the rail tracks to Redmond and Bellevue right now. And
that's going to happen no matter what.
That's happening, yeah.
The voters have consistently expressed a desire for more light rail. And as for this being pushed through in a sudden fashion, the first ST3 workshop was in 2012. So, and historically in the past, when we've tried to pass packages that do a little bit of light rail here and a little bit of roads here and a little bit of highway here, that failed. So we've been able to demonstrate that when we pass an aggressive light rail package, we get it done and we see the results.
C.R. Douglas's train just pulled up.
Sorry.
Yeah. No, that's fine. It's been fun to kind of see the back and forth, hear the back and forth. One thing, you know, the junkie in me has to point out, it's interesting. I mean, Breyer's got an articulate, you know, presentation here today, but we should say back in 2008, the Times didn't support that either. I mean, editorially, they were against the 2008 vote. They said in 2007, we want a smaller, better system. And then 2008, when that came up, they opposed it. So I just point that out. But I haven't taken a position on this. I can't in my role. But I will say that you talk to the folks who are leading this. They're pretty optimistic. Polls show this is going to win. And I think a couple reasons for that, even though the cost is astronomical and the timeline is brutal, I think two things that it's unlike the first two votes on light rail. This is not theoretical. There was no light rail during the first vote, of course. There was no light rail hadn't even opened in 2008 in the second vote. It was just still a theory. Now it's been up and running. People have seen it. People have ridden it. People have heard about the record numbers. You know, the new Capitol Hill and UW station are getting all kinds of fanfare. So I think that's part of why this is doing very well, even in its first time around. And secondly, the alternative is, you know, and I've done some debates on this. We hosted one little air this week. The opponents, though they, you know, they make a kind of convincing case about the high price and all that kind of stuff, they don't have a great alternative. So the problem, if you're looking for some answer, and why I think this is doing well, is that the alternative just isn't vetted. You know, they talk about kind of more bus rapid transit lanes, and that's kind of, you know, no one knows how much that costs. They don't have a price tag for that. It sort of seems like they get stuck in traffic. And, you know, so there's not a great alternative to vote on, which I think is helping this in the polls.
Well, Breyer, at least at the minimum, you wanted the alternative of more accountability, more public input along the way.
Absolutely. And, you know, I don't think people realize how much we're already investing in Sound Transit right now. And that between, you know, as we said in the editorial, between now and 2040, there's going to be like, what, a 56% increase in transit use without Sound Transit 3. I mean, we're already, you know, most people that work in Seattle, in downtown Seattle, use transit. We're actually phenomenal that way. We're phenomenal with carpools. And Sound Transit 2 is going to bring huge increases in capacity to that system. And then we're going to see just this kind of small incremental jump with Sound Transit 3. About, you know, even Sound Transit's predicting maybe about a 10% increase in transit trips from Sound Transit 2 to Sound Transit 3. So for that maybe 10% gain, we're paying $54 billion, and we don't really have a chance to say, hey, this isn't quite what we wanted. Let's do it a little bit differently. Let's move the tunnel here. Let's move the tunnel there. I mean, we're going to lock it all in, and it's going
to
be done.
Sydney, I know you would love to rebut that, but we have to pause it here. I interviewed a couple of a yes on Sound Transit 3 and a no on Sound Transit 3. That's also at KUOW.org. And we're going to continue in a moment on the Week in Review. Where is Seattle going to allow its homeless people to camp? Stay tuned. On KUOW, I'm Bill Radke. This is your Week in Review with the Seattle Times and The Stranger and Q13 Fox, Breyer Dudley, Sidney Brownstone, C.R. Douglas. What didn't happen this week was a vote on how to let people camp in Seattle's public spaces. Sidney, what's happening with this?
It's really fascinating. I mean, we've seen some conflicting views pop up on the Seattle City Council. Basically, there were two competing homeless sweeps pieces of legislation. One was sponsored by Councilmember Sally Bagshaw, and the other one was sponsored by Councilmember Mike O'Brien. And if you really want to simplify things, they both kind of catered to two different political interests in the city. Bagshaw's leaned more heavily towards towards homeowners who felt like they were being inconvenienced by these homeless encampments. And Mike O'Brien's leaned more towards homeless advocates who want to see people in the encampments treated more humanely than they currently are. So
I think those homeowners might characterize it a little differently, but we'll get into that perhaps.
You should go on next door sometime, Bill, and see what those homeowners are saying about the homeless people in their neighborhoods. So there were a number of important differences between the two pieces of legislation, but they also laid out very different processes for homeless sweeps and encampment suites. Under Bagshaw's proposal, the city could sweep people after 72 hours if housing or shelter was available for them. And O'Brien's proposal would allow sweeps only after 30 days and only if housing is available. I believe that's changed now, and the mayor has come in with his own proposal. And the biggest controversy is when people are sweeped, where do they go? Do we only sweep when there's housing available? Some people really don't like staying in the shelter system. And there are reasons for that. You know, the religious element is one of them. Sometimes they don't feel safe. So that's the biggest controversy on the table right now. And the voting on the legislation has been delayed until November or December.
Breyer, since homeless people are already camping in Seattle, why are some residents so upset about this proposal?
Well, first off, let me just address the homeowner versus homeless advocate thing there. I think that's false, and I think that people who are upset about this are homeowners, they're renters, they're people across the city. There's this kind of false narrative that it's homeowners against everybody else in Seattle that's perpetuated by the Stranger and even more lately by Mayor Ed Murray to advance their various agendas, and I think it's not productive. I think that the conversation needs to be about what's best for everyone in Seattle.
What's in it for Mayor Murray to pit homeowners against, theoretically, homeowners against homeless advocates?
Well, that goes into HALA and density, which we don't have.
Okay.
We don't have 4 hours to talk about that one. But you know, this is a growing city. Everybody's looking for space. Parks and open space are public assets. That land is your land. It's my land, you know. And so should somebody be able to take it for themselves?
Well, if it's their land too, why can't they sleep there if there's
it's shared.
It works for them.
It's shared.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
we share it that way?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, how did you feel about the guys in West Seattle that cut all those trees on public right of way? You know, they said, hey, that's our, you know, they unilaterally decided that they could.
You have your land, we have our view. Yeah, everybody's happy.
Exactly. So, it kind of. This is a compassionate city, and we care about the neediest, and we care about the unsheltered, and we're doing a lot for them, and we continue to do more. And actually, the city is finally getting its act together. It seems like they hired consultants, and the city and county are coming up with some really good ideas. They, you know, the Murray's consultant said that there are enough shelter beds for all the unsheltered people in King County if we figure out how to move people from transitional and make room for the truly unsheltered. We can accommodate them all. There's a good plan that's in the works. And if you just say, sort of come out with these muddy, yeah, you can just camp anywhere things, it's going to be really hard to enforce. It's going to make it really hard for the police to figure out, you know, should this person go or should they not go? And, you know, at some point, you got to say, you know, take the help that's available or move on.
So there are more resources on the way, but in the meantime, it's getting dark and wet and cold, and we have to figure out what to do. CR, what I don't understand is, as I said, homeless people are already camping where they can. Why is there a fight over making the enforcement of the law official? I mean, it's happening unofficially now. Why is this so important to people?
Well, partly because the advocates, the ACLU and others, have really wanted to kind of push this envelope, if you will. So that's kind of created this. But it's because the problem's getting worse, and it's happening in more places around town. And so you're getting a lot more energy around this issue, a lot of people commenting about it, a lot of people worried about it, a lot of people coming from all different angles. You talk to people at City Hall, the backlash on this idea of sort of allowing more camping, being more liberal, if you will, on that, is greater. The backlash is greater than anything they've experienced in probably 2 or 3 decades. It's huge. It's huge. And
I think they miscalculated?
I think they did miscalculate. And so my guess is that you're going to have nothing happen at the council level. You know, Burgess was kind of the only guy that was sort of against this you know, camping everywhere policy, and he's slowly kind of adding a coalition. I think he's got four now. I think he'll probably soon get five. So I think what you have is a real quick pivot at City Hall. I think you're going to move in the direction of creating four authorized encampments. The mayor has talked about that. Haven't located them yet, but four authorized encampments in addition to the three authorized city camps you have now, so we'll probably have seven and not that long, where they will sort of put a lot of these folks. That's, I think, where this is going. You are not going to have a situation where you've got this camping in parks and sidewalks and that kind of stuff. It just, the backlash was huge. And I would say it is not just homeowners. I mean, there were sports fields advocates. There were soccer teams. There were a lot of folks that used these areas that didn't want this.
Okay, so we just have a couple of minutes before we say goodbye. So, Breyer, are you happy with that? Authorized encampments with that are, you know, with services and more sort of policing, you know, rules enforced rather than sweep it here, sweep it there?
No, I'm not happy because the bottom rung of our society is still suffering, and even an encampment isn't the best for them. And there's a lot of – we need a – broader coordinated response to help these people. I think the mental health system also needs better, more investment at the state level. That'll help too.
Sydney's nodding her head in agreement.
I actually agree with you, Breyer, on that. We do need more investment in our mental health system. We need safe consumption sites. But the bottom line is I think people are more important than this kind of like weird mythical idea of parks. And if a park is truly public, it should allow all members of the public to be there for whatever purposes they need them to. That's legal.
I think a central question here is what, when it comes to homelessness, what is compassionate? What does compassion look like in action? So I want to turn this to the listener because we're out of time for now, but we can keep talking about this. Email us at record@kuow.org, record@kuow.org, or call us 206-221-3663, 221-3663, and we'll keep covering this with your help. What does compassion look like in this situation? I want to thank our Week in Review panel this hour from The Stranger, Sydney Brownstone, from The Seattle Times, Breyer Dudley, from Q13 Fox, C.R. Douglas. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's the Week in Review. We'll do it again on this coming Friday. Thanks for tuning in.